States Court of Appeals in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. Sorry to get everybody here earlier and then delay. We'll blame it on Amtrak. First case of the morning is Davis versus Cook County. Mr. Morrissey.
Good morning. I'd like to change my rebuttal time from 5 minutes to 3 minutes, if that's okay with
you. Okay, you watch your watch.
The district court erred, Your Honor, when they granted summary judgment to the defendant, Cook County, and failed to consider any of the facts, additional facts raised by the plaintiff, that there's a delay in delivering methadone to methadone-dependent inmates when they come into the jail. A reasonable jury could have inferred from the evidence that this delay in delivering methadone to the inmates caused the plaintiff in this case, the decedent, Mr. Davis, to suffer unnecessarily and pain and suffering during the 5 days prior to his death. There's no question in regards to the fact that Mr. Davis had been treated for 2 years on a daily basis for methadone prior to coming into the jail on Friday, September 27th, to serve a 10-day sentence. There's also no question that Mr. Davis, when he came into the jail and during the medical intake, told the CIRMAC employee that he was receiving methadone on a daily basis and that he was receiving it from a specific clinic, the SASE clinic in Chicago. There's also a procedure at CIRMAC in which the medical intake person then fills out a referral card, and the inmate signs that referral card. The referral card then gets transferred over to the pharmacy department, and the practice is for a licensed pharmacist then to call the outside agency to confirm that the inmate is actually receiving methadone and to find out what the specific dose is. In this case, there's no question that on Saturday and Sunday, that Mr. Davis was, there was no call to the SASE clinic to determine.
Let me ask you this, and you're certainly outlining the facts as you've laid them out in your brief, but I want to talk about establishing a claim under Monell, and what series of past bad acts are you claiming? I understand what the normal procedure is, but I just want to get a handle on that.
Well, there's two ways that we would prove it. First of all, is from the obvious thing that they don't have adequate staffing with the pharmacists on the weekend. There's only one pharmacist. There should be four. Second, that the pharmacist, once they do confirm it with the outsigning agency, they don't even put down the name of the person that they talk to over in the jail. All they do is call over to the jail, leave a message for that the person is eligible, and they don't do anything further to verify or to monitor that person is brought over to the pharmacy to receive the medicine. There is also much evidence in regards to a widespread practice at the jail. We have Officer Collier, who's been there for 14 years. Officer Collier said that it takes 3 days before the pharmacy department confirms it. We have social worker Bauer telling the decedent in this case that, based upon her knowledge, it's 3 days for the pharmacy department to confirm it. We have Mr. Singh, who's the pharmacist in charge of this case, says that even after they confirm it with the outside agency, there's usually at least a day delay before the inmate is brought over by a correction guard to the pharmacy to receive the medicine. Furthermore, we have the Officer Carter. When Mrs. Davis, on Tuesday, called after she talked to her husband and was directed to Officer Carter, because Officer Carter was a security officer and all incoming calls to Division 2 would have been directed to Officer Carter, she told Officer Carter that her husband came in on Friday and still had not received his methadone. Practically 4 days had elapsed. She told her, based upon our policy there, that's not uncommon. It just doesn't work that fast in the jail. So what we have, Your Honor, we have a practice where normally they have four pharmacists on duty. On the weekends, with the same number of inmates in the jail, the 10,000 inmates, and the same medical needs, they have only one pharmacist on duty. That pharmacist has to fill the prescriptions and also, presumably, check and see if the person that came into the jail recently is eligible for methadone. The facts are, in this case, that on Saturday and Sunday, over the weekend, which is the practice, there was no calls made to the SASE clinic. Also, what we know is that Mr. Davis became symptomatic. He became symptomatic the day after he came into the jail. We know that from a fellow inmate, Mr. Santiago. He observed Mr. Davis on Saturday and Sunday, found that he was withdrawing from methadone. Furthermore, we have an expert, a pharmacologist, Dr. O'Donnell, who testified that after 24 hours, after you haven't received your daily dose within 24 hours, you're going to become symptomatic, and it's going to progress as the time goes on. Now, we clearly have a practice that we laid out in our brief, responding to the Monell issue raised by the defendants, that they have a practice that there was a delay in delivery of methadone. And it's clear that if you're not receiving methadone within one day, you're going to become symptomatic. In addition to that, we have individual defendants in this case. We have an Officer Collier. Officer Collier came on duty on Tuesday, 3 or 4 days after the inmate came into the jail. He came on duty at 7 o'clock in the morning. Inmates in dorm four told him, hey, Mr. Davis, he's withdrawing from drugs. He's dope sick. Mr. Davis yells out, it feels like my stomach is ripping out. He knew, unlike perhaps the individuals in Faulkner, he knew that Mr. Davis had a serious medical condition. He knew that there was an objective serious medical condition. He then walks over and talks to a social worker, Bauer. The fact is, however, Officer Collier has no knowledge whether Ms. Bauer ever calls over to the paramedics in the building to get help. All that Mr. Collier does is he alerts his sergeant, who was also there, a Sergeant Martin, and then he proceeds on to his business. We know that Ms. Bauer knew that he had a serious medical condition, unlike the two defendants in Faulkner, because when she saw him, Mr. Davis, in that dorm, she said he looked terrible. What does she do? She tries to call a paramedic. Her notes from that day, right after she saw Mr. Davis, say that Collier and I tried to get medical attention, but no paramedics had been in the building at that time. Well, they weren't in the building because it was 7 o'clock in the morning, and the paramedics don't come in until later. There's no evidence from Ms. Bauer or from the defendants that she made any subsequent attempt that day to alert the paramedics. It's clear that Ms. Bauer was deliberately indifferent when she didn't do anything further. She knew he was suffering terribly, he looked terrible, and she did nothing further to get him medical care other than to tell the sergeant who was also there, Sergeant Martin, that, hey, don't put this guy on the work duty that day because he's sick. We have Sergeant Martin. Now, the defendants will say that Sergeant Martin, there's no evidence that he participated in this delay in providing methadone to Mr. Davis. That's not true. We have two people. We have Mr. Collier, Officer Collier, and we also have Ms. Bauer, who says that Sergeant Martin was present when she talked to Mr. Davis. We can infer that he knew that there was a serious medical condition because Ms. Bauer said he looked terrible. So if Ms. Bauer acknowledged that he looked terrible, Sergeant Martin certainly must have drawn the inference that he looked terrible. Sergeant Martin and Officer Collier both have the duty, when they see an inmate that's in a serious medical condition, to provide access to medical care. It's not the duty of the social worker. It's the sergeant and the officer's duty to do that. In fact, Sergeant Martin contends that as the sergeant and the supervisor, he would be the one responsible, not a social worker, for getting medical attention. We know that there was no medical attention provided by any of these defendants. In addition, we have Officer Carter. Now, the testimony that Ms. Davis and what the defendants agreed to is that on Tuesday, Mrs. Davis talked to her husband. Following her conversation with her husband, she called the jail, and she was directed to Division 2. The person that would have received the call in Division 2 would be the security officer. Officer Carter admits that she was a security officer that day. What Mrs. Davis said, and there's no dispute that she told an employee by the name of Carter, that her husband, who came in on Friday, had not received methadone, and yet who was suffering severe headaches, pain, and suffering, and she wanted attention for her husband. What Officer Carter said to her at that time was clearly that the jail doesn't work that way. That we have a practice, they don't get their methadone within a day or two. It takes a while.
And what day was this?
This was Tuesday,
so
about noontime.
So it's been what? He's been
it's
there
been
3 days?
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. It's been four days. So we know that Officer Carter knew it was a serious medical condition because she was told by Mrs. Davis. She had the responsibility to alert people that they should provide some medical access for him, and she did nothing. We also have the paramedics in this case. We have paramedic Westbrook, and we have paramedic Padden. Now, Cermak says that denies that that social worker Bauer ever called over. She denies that there was ever any call to the paramedics in the building. If, in the alternative, there was a call made to the paramedics, paramedics Westbrook and Padden should have provided medical care. So
wasn't there testimony really they didn't have any recollection of receiving a call from Bauer?
That's correct. They don't deny, Your Honor, that they received a call from Bauer. They just can't recall. At this time, if there's no further questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Ellenberger?
May it please the Court, my name is Lynn Ellenberger, and I represent five employees of the Sheriff's Office of Cook County: Lieutenant Anita Mackey, Officer Yolanda Carter, Correctional Rehabilitation Worker Regina Bowers, Officer Gregory Collier, and Sergeant Grant Martin. All of these individuals are sued in their individual capacity. The District Court granted summary judgment in favor of these individual Sheriff's Office employees, and this decision should be affirmed. The 1983 claims asserted against these individuals turn on the question of whether they were deliberately indifferent to James Davis's medical needs. All of those individuals had contact with Mr. Davis on only one day, and that was October 1st of 2002. That was that Tuesday. Farmer versus Brennan teaches that deliberate indifference, a plaintiff must show that the official must be aware of facts from which the inference could be drawn of a substantial risk of serious harm, and that individual must draw that inference. In Chapman versus Keltner, this court set out the parameters of the deliberate indifference standard. The plaintiff must show that the official was aware of the risk and consciously disregarded it. Negligence or even gross negligence is not enough to establish liability under 1983. Instead, the official must have a substantially culpable state of mind and must act in an intentional or criminally reckless manner. The district court's decision should be affirmed on two grounds. First, Mr. Davis was treated within approximately 12 hours of his first contact with the first sheriff's office employee, Officer Collier. Second, when the actions of each of the individual employees are examined separately, none of them rise to the level of deliberate indifference, and plaintiff has failed to put forth any facts to show that they acted with deliberate indifference.
Well, Officer Collier certainly knew the condition was serious.
That is correct.
And he knew that he was in withdrawal. I mean, it appeared to be apparent. The inmates had said so, and so he knew that he was dope sick, didn't he?
He did. He heard Mr.
And all he did was report that to the sergeant?
Officer Collier first took Mr. Davis to see social worker Bowers because he believed that she could expedite him getting medical attention. A social worker, in his view, could override decisions of the medical staff and direct the medical staff to the inmate. Secondly, he informed his supervisor, Sergeant Martin, that Mr. Davis was not feeling well and that he took Mr. Davis to see social worker Bowers. Those are the two steps that Officer Collier did to discharge his duties to Mr. Davis.
Right, and how long was he on duty?
Officer Collier was on duty that day from 7 until 3.
Right, and nothing happened between 7 and 3 after he took those steps, correct? He was still there, he was still dope sick, still in a very serious condition.
That is correct.
And so isn't that sufficient to show deliberate indifference? And even though I understand what your position is, isn't that certainly enough of a dispute such that the jury should have made this determination?
It is not, I believe, because under the facts as set out here that are undisputed by the plaintiff, Officer Collier took Mr. Davis to see Ms. Bowers. He stood there while she called the paramedics. His testimony is undisputed that he overheard her speak with a person on the other end of the telephone. Ms. Bowers also clearly testified that she spoke with someone on the other end of the phone. Now, plaintiff has repeatedly attempted to contest that fact, but the district court found that the plaintiff had improperly contested that fact because the portion of the record to which the plaintiff pointed, the logbook that counsel referenced in his argument, does not show that Ms. Bowers did not make contact with a paramedic. There was contact made. These paramedics were put on notice that this individual was present and needed attention. No attention was given until around 7 o'clock that evening.
Yes, and so that's what I'm trying to get at. Even if we give you that there was no factual dispute, there's no dispute that after she made the call, even if we give you that, that all those hours lapsed when he got no care, she knew it and Collier knew it.
That is correct, that they knew it. However, when you look at the facts... And
so was it they can just drop the ball on something like that?
I don't
with
believe
no consequence. I mean, isn't that that's what I'm trying to get at? Isn't that sufficient material? I mean, that really is not in dispute, and so shouldn't the jury make that determination as whether that's reckless disregard?
I don't believe that they should. A perfect example is the Quion versus Couts case out of this court, and in that case, this court held that the plaintiff presented evidence that his jailers acted unreasonably with regard to his medical condition, but he failed to present evidence that they acted deliberately. It needs to be shown, and plaintiff has failed to show, that these individuals acted with intent, this criminal recklessness that's established under the Farmer standard. That's not present here. These officers discharged their duty. They tried to help Mr. Davis. It's unfortunate that he didn't get help until that evening, but that doesn't rise to the level of deliberate indifference.
No, the help they got that evening was more superficial, wasn't it? It wasn't the methadone.
He did not receive methadone. He received a medication that was to alleviate the methadone withdrawal symptoms that he was experiencing. However, as...
So the bottom line is, once he got the treatment, it still wasn't for methadone. He still didn't get his methadone.
It wasn't methadone. Respectfully, Your Honor, when we look to the appropriateness of the medication and whether the treatment was appropriate, that is bordering closer on a medical negligence case, and the proper venue for such a case is not this court, but is in state court. Because Mr. Davis was treated that evening, there cannot be deliberate indifference as a matter of law. Wells versus Franzen, this court has suggested that a treatment generally defeats a claim of deliberate indifference. With respect to Sergeant Grant Martin, he was not personally involved in these events relating to Mr. Davis. The testimony is undisputed that he...
Of course, he was the supervisor there, so he had the responsibility to get the paramedics there, right?
He was the supervisor, but I believe under these facts, knowing that Collier and Bowers informed him that they took steps to get Mr. Davis medical attention, it cannot amount to deliberate indifference on his part.
Even though their steps failed. So
even
you're saying he's completely off the hook, even though the man is still there for all those hours with no treatment.
Because, again, he didn't have the culpable state of mind with deliberately intending to harm Mr. Davis. And as for Sergeant...
Can't deliberate harm also be indifference? Can it, at some point, can't indifference become deliberate harm?
It would have to be a knowing disregard of facts or a conscious disregard of facts that are present, that are presented to an officer to amount to deliberate indifference. For these reasons, we ask that the decision of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Pichoff?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Donald Pekus. I represent Cook County and the paramedics Westbrook, Patton, Moore, and Hill. As to the paramedics, the plaintiff has conceded at summary judgment and the briefs on appeal that Ms. Bowers never made a phone call to any of the paramedics. I submit that what the two paramedics testified to, that they don't recall receiving a phone call. And the other two paramedics who said, I firmly state I never received a phone call. There's no difference in that. The plaintiff cannot prove, they've conceded it, but also the plaintiff cannot prove that the phone call ever occurred.
Well, who would answer the phone other than paramedics?
There was testimony that somebody, like a clerk in the dispensary, could have answered the phone.
A clerk who what? Dispatches paramedics?
A scheduling clerk. But more importantly, Your Honor, even if that was to be believed, that Bowers made that phone call, her testimony was, I told the unknown paramedic that Mr. Davis was not feeling well and was rubbing his stomach. So what we have is a stomach ache. And this court has previously held that that's something that people don't go to doctor for.
But that's not what the inmates were talking about, the fact that he was dope sick. And he indicated he was on methadone. And he had said that when he came in. I want to eventually get to the Monell claim.
I'm going to move on to that. But the phone call, the only information in the record that was provided to this unknown paramedic was, Mr. Davis is not feeling well and he has a stomach ache. That is it. Nothing else about him being dope sick. Nothing about methadone. It was a stomach ache. It's like the sniffles. It's something. The information transmitted was of a minor problem.
The paramedics don't keep any kind of log of phone calls that provides more descriptive information than that?
Not of phone calls of people who are brought to the clinic or people that they go and treat in the various living units.
So they don't keep any kind of physical record, written record, of calls that come in from various parts of the jail asking for their services?
If they get a call, they respond, they treat them, they do a record. The bare phone call, no. As Mr. Morrissey stated, at the time the call was supposedly made, there were no paramedics in the building. They don't come on duty till 8 o'clock. There's an emergency room. If anyone needs to go to the emergency room, there's a 24-hour emergency room. But at 7 o'clock in the morning, there are no paramedics in the building.
Well, that's why I asked who answered the phone. I can understand if a paramedic answers the phone, somebody says, we've got an emergency here, he's not going to write it down in a log. Okay, he's got to go. But if the paramedic, somebody answers the phone routinely and dispatches a paramedic, but we don't seem to have that, right?
There's no evidence that there was someone there as a matter of routine at that time of day answering the phone. This was purely Ms. Bowers' testimony. I called the dispensary. Someone answered the phone. I don't know who it was. I told them he had a stomach ache, and this person told me it takes 3 days to get methadone. If I can move on to the Monell claims.
The person who answered the phone said that?
According to Ms. Bowers, that's what the person who answered the phone said.
Well, that's an interesting response to a stomachache.
Ms. Bowers allegedly said to this unknown person, the person is waiting to get methadone.
Oh.
He's not feeling well. He's rubbing his stomach.
So it's more than a stomachache.
Well, there was the information transmitted that there was no methadone, but his physical condition was a stomach ache. That was the information transmitted.
I just want to follow up on what Judge Mannion said. So it makes no sense if it was just they were just told it was a stomach ache that the response would be he can't get methadone for 3 days.
I'm sorry, I don't follow you, Judge.
Well, I don't follow you. I don't follow that argument when you're saying that you don't know who, she doesn't know who responded.
Right.
It wasn't a paramedic, and yet the response back to her was, you can't get methadone treatment for 3 days.
That is what she testified to. And as far as the county is concerned, there was no one in that clinic at that time. At 7 in the morning. Not till 8 in the morning does someone get there.
But there were emergency measures that could have been taken if the paramedics weren't there, because he could have been sent right to the hospital.
Absolutely. He could have gone to
And no one thought to do that. when there was, I understand, nobody's there from 7 to 8, and nobody sent him to the hospital.
If he was brought to the clinic, to the emergency room, he would have been treated.
Right. Right. And that's an option. That's open 24/7.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let me get to the Monell claim, because as I understand it, Cook County admitted there's only one pharmacist on duty to do the work of four on the weekend. There are routine delays of several days before the inmates get their methadone. There were no procedures documenting the calls between the pharmacy and the security personnel. Isn't that sufficient to raise a factual issue of whether this was a widespread practice that caused harm to Mr. Davis, particularly in light of the witnesses that testified to this?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The testimony of Mr. Singh, he spent 30 years there as a pharmacist. He testified Monday through Friday, there's four pharmacists on duty. Saturday and Sunday, there's one. He's asked, and he testified, and the plaintiff has ignored this testimony, there is less workload on the weekends because there are less doctors on the premises writing prescriptions. The clinics that are held every day in the divisions, there's 10 divisions, there's a clinic every day, inmates are seen every day. Those aren't held on the weekends. There are less doctors. There's only the emergency room operating, so there's less prescriptions. They just can't show, there's no nexus between one pharmacist on duty and Mr. Davis not getting the methadone. And Mr. Singh also testified that pharmacists call the methadone programs on the weekends, but the clinics are not always open. I have to take issue with Mr. Morrissey.
Well, let's get back to Singh just a minute. Didn't he also say that he was aware that there were times when there were delays of more than one day between his call to security and when an inmate is actually brought to the pharmacy? And that there's no records that are being kept to determine how long it takes to bring an inmate up for methadone?
He testified that there are... In 30 years, he's seen delays of up to a day, not usually a day, as counsel told you. He said once in a while. It's not a regular feature.
Didn't Collier and Mackey say that they heard it could take up to 3 days or even a week to get methadone
everything
to an inmate?
Their entire case is based on generalized evidence, conjecture and speculation. This court has rejected those, and I'm out of time. I have to rely on my brief at this point. What's the court?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Morrissey. You have 4 minutes.
I just have a few comments, Your Honor. On Tuesday, he came in on Friday. On Tuesday, the testimony of Officer Collier is that he heard Mr. Davis cry out, "It feels like my stomach is ripping out." The inmates told Collier that he was dope sick withdrawing. The social worker who saw him that day said he looked terrible. That's what her words were. Mr. Davis looked terrible.
And what day is this?
This is Tuesday.
Okay.
When they first saw him at 7 o'clock in the morning. To say that it was merely a stomach ache is not true. He was suffering after 4 or 5 days. Severe withdrawal symptoms from methadone.
And then he had that cerebral aneurysm the next day and died on Thursday. I couldn't help but notice you dropped the wrongful death claim. There's nothing in the record that indicates as to why. Are you in a position to respond to that?
Well, we dropped the wrongful death because we couldn't show the nexus between not receiving methadone and having a cerebral aneurysm. So that's why we did drop it after expert testimony, Your Honor.
So your lawsuit then here is just limited to the suffering during the 3 or 4 days he...
The 4 or 5 days prior to his death, he had an agonizing death, Your Honor, and it was caused by not having the methadone. That's the testimony of the expert who said within 24 hours a person would start suffering withdrawal symptoms. And as we saw with Mr. Davis, each day it got worse. We know that he was suffering because there was he's not here to tell us, but there was an inmate that was present on Saturday that witnessed the symptoms that he was suffering, Mr. Santiago.
None of the jail employees who are individual defendants here had notice of his suffering until Tuesday, as I understand the record.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. We have no evidence that any of the individual defendants knew about it until Tuesday at 7 in the morning.
So with respect to the individual defendants, the claim consists of that 12-hour period from the time that they did have notice till the time that he received some treatment.
That's correct. Now, they mention, Ms. Lindberg, Ellenberg mentioned there was a case, Wells, that states that if you get some medical attention, that could be sufficient normally. Well, with Wells, the person had a rash and a headache. And sometime later, a day later, he did receive some lotion. This isn't that case. This is a case where somebody is suffering extreme withdrawal symptoms. And everybody knows that. All the defendants know, individual defendants know that, yet they take no steps. They don't call an emergency paramedic to come over. They allow him to sit there in their presence for 12 hours and have this agonizing withdrawal period. I'd also like to take issue in regards to Sergeant Martin. There is no evidence in the record that Ms. Bauer, when she talked to Mr. Martin in Mr. Davis's presence, that Sergeant Martin was aware that that Social Worker Bauer attempted to make a call to the paramedics. So the information we have in regards to Martin is that he was the supervisor. He was ultimately the person who was responsible. He's there. He sees the condition of Mr. Davis. Everybody says it's terrible. And yet he does nothing as the supervising sergeant to make sure that he gets medical care for 12 or 13 hours. Now, the care that he got was not methadone. Everybody acknowledges that 12 or 13 hours later, he gets a placebo, which didn't address his severe methadone withdrawals. During that 12 or 13 hours, when all these individuals knew that he was suffering from withdrawal symptoms, did anybody take the step to contact the pharmacy and say, hey, is he eligible for methadone? No. There's no testimony they took any step to do that. I think the incident with Monell, that the practice of the delay is illustrated by the plaintiff in this case. And on the weekends, there's no calls made to the clinics. There was no call made for Mr. Davis. And there was no call follow-up by Singh on Monday after he confirmed it. They waited 2 or 3 days, and there was no monitoring to make sure that he got his medication. I see my latest. Thank you, Renner.
Thank you. This case will be taken under advisement.